From the Voice of America in Washington, D.C., this is VOA Global. Hello to you on this final day of the year, 2014, here in Washington. Jim Stevenson has the day off. I'm Ira Melman. On the program today, weather and high waves in the Java Sea hamper efforts to learn what happened to the Air Asia airplane that went down there. Jim Stevenson talks with an author who is trying to answer questions about Chinese domination. Sarah Williams examines the Tibetan protest movement in her China Focus report. And as the weather gets colder in the Northern Hemisphere, the body's reaction to it, shivering, could have some beneficial effects. That's all part of American Cafe today, and many will imbibe alcoholic beverages to celebrate the start of the new year. David Burr talks about how much is too much. From the Voice of America, this is Daybreak Asia on VOA Global. I'm Ira Melman. Jim Stevenson is off today. We begin today with the crash of Air Asia Flight 8501. Stormy weather, high waves in the Java Sea continue to hamper efforts to learn what happened to that Air Asia jetliner that went down this week with the apparent loss of more than 160 people on board. The bodies of seven victims have been recovered, and authorities now believe they have located the main body of the plane, an Airbus A300. Families are being prepared for the grim task of identifying their loved ones. Ron Corbin has more for VOA from Bangkok.
Heavy grey clouds and rain forced Indonesian rescuers to call off the search for the missing Air Asia Flight 8501, which went down Sunday over the Java Sea on a flight through severe monsoon storms. The Air Asia Airbus A300, with 162 passengers and crew on board, had left Surabaya, Indonesia, on a routine two-hour flight to Singapore. Many on board were travelling to mark the new year with friends and relatives. Radar contact was lost with the airliner just after the Indonesian pilot had requested a new flight path to avoid the storms. The request to take the aircraft to a higher altitude was denied because of other air traffic in the area. After the sighting of debris Tuesday, relatives of those on board had hoped for a quick recovery of bodies from the crash scene to begin the grim process of identification at Pangkalan Bun in central Kalimantan. Indonesia's National Search and Rescue Agency Chief Bambang Suluyistyo said weather was hampering recovery operation. Suluyistyo said one of the bodies recovered had a life jacket on. Other items found include an aircraft exit door and a suitcase. Indonesian television Wednesday showed preparations being made at a victim identification centre at Pangkalan Bun, with hospital gurneys and medical staff ready for the task of identification. But the tragedy has drawn the region together with offers of assistance across the Asia-Pacific area. Several nations offered search and assistance to Indonesia, including Singapore, Malaysia, Australia, China, South Korea and the United States. While preliminary investigations have blamed the heavy monsoon weather over the Java Sea for the accident in the early hours of Sunday, Indonesian transport officials say background checks were being carried out on all passengers as part of standard procedures. Air Asia's chief executive, Tony Fernandes, launched the low-cost carrier in 2001, and it is now a leading operator in Asia with over 170 aircraft through ventures in the Philippines, Thailand and Indonesia, and parent company based in Malaysia. Rapid growth of the low-cost aviation sector has been spurred by the region's economic expansion and rising incomes. AirAsia's share prices slumped earlier in the week, soon after news Flight 8501 was missing. But Daniel Wong, an analyst with Kuala Lumpur-based Hong Leong Investment Bank, says the medium-term financial impact on AirAsia is uncertain.
I would say there is some impact on it, but then at the end of the day, for the regional travel, it depends on the affordability of the consumer. The Asia, the Southeast Asian region, the emerging traveler are basically on a mid-income to low-income rather than a high-income group. Low-income, mid-income to low-income group, they have no other choice, they will still go for low-cost carrier rather than full-service carrier.
The latest tragedy leaves 2014 a dark year in Asia's aviation. After the missing and still unrecovered Malaysia Airlines flight MH370 in March with 239 passengers and crew, and in July the loss of 298 lives after Malaysia Airlines flight 17 crashed in eastern Ukraine. Ron Corbin for VOA News, Bangkok, Thailand.
The United States is continuing to insist that North Korea hacked into the corporate computers at Sony Pictures Entertainment and released a trove of information, but private investigators are saying they believe the cybersecurity attack was launched by a disgruntled former worker at the film company. FBI agents met this week with officials at a prominent American cyber intelligence firm. Company is claiming that a Sony insider possibly working with hackers outside the company penetrated company files. Defense attorneys in Pakistan have alleged the government rearrested the suspected leader of the 2008 Mumbai attacks on fake charges to appease India. Ayaz Gul reports from Islamabad that authorities in Pakistan appear to have a problem because the release of the man could further raise tensions with India, and attempting to influence the judiciary could draw some massive criticism at home.
The accused Zakir Rahman Lakhvi is one of seven suspects being tried in Pakistan on charges of planning the Mumbai attacks that killed 166 people. The men were arrested shortly after the deadly 2008 militant raid in the Indian commercial capital, and New Delhi has since been demanding Islamabad prosecute and punish them. However, earlier this month, the anti-terrorism court trying the suspects ordered Lakhvi be released on bail, citing a lack of evidence and flaws in the prosecution's case. The ruling outraged India, but tensions eased after Pakistani authorities ordered Lakhvi to remain in custody under a public order law. Defense attorneys successfully contested the detention order in a higher court that ruled on Monday that the suspected militant leader could be freed on bail. But hours after Lakhvi won the appeal, police rearrested him on new kidnapping charges. Defense lawyer Rizwan Abbasi says he has launched new challenges against what he criticized as fake charges and the ghost complainant. Abbasi says his client has been in jail for more than 6 years, so how could someone in custody have kidnapped anybody?
It is alleged against my client that he has abducted one person who is in his custody since last more than 6.5 years. How it is possible that a person who was in jail since last 6 years, he can retain someone in his custody? From the face of it, this allegation is ridiculous.
Attorney Abbasi says that Pakistani authorities are reluctant to release his client because they do not want to upset India.
It is very clear that on Indian pressure, my client has been put in custody just to deprive him from the right of liberty.
India summoned the Pakistani envoy in New Delhi to the foreign ministry to protest Monday's first ruling that appeared to free Lakhvi. He's expected to appear before the court on Thursday when a report detailing the police investigation into the kidnapping charges is submitted. The suspects on trial in Pakistan are allegedly members of the outlawed militant group Lashkar-e-Taiba that India accuses of being behind the 2008 Mumbai carnage. The latest back and forth in the high-profile case comes as relations between Pakistan and India have plunged to new lows in the wake of recent border clashes. However, Pakistani officials maintain the country's judiciary is independent and the government cannot interfere in the legal proceedings. Both the rival countries reported fresh clashes on Wednesday along the disputed border in Kashmir. The cross-border firing is said to have killed two Pakistani soldiers and an Indian soldier. It is unclear who initiated the fire. Ayaz Gul for VOA News, Islamabad.
Here on VOA Global, this is our audience participation segment. We'll read to you some of the stories we've been covering and then read to you some of the comments we have received. And we urge you to write in to us at voanews.com, also on Facebook at VOA Asia. Police in northwestern Pakistan say they've detained a key militant commander who's accused in the 2012 killing of a reporter for Voice of America's Diwa Radio. But Willie Webb from Phoenix, Arizona, here in the United States, says nothing can put anyone beyond susceptibility to the Taliban's murderous plans. Pakistan is finally cleaning out their hideouts, and the U.S. drone program will continue to pick them off whenever possible. South Korean authorities have arrested a former airline executive who set off a firestorm of criticism by complaining about the way a flight attendant served her some macadamia nuts on board one of the planes. Heather Cho, who's the daughter of the Korean Airlines chief executive, was taken into custody Wednesday in Seoul on allegations of violating aviation safety. Augustus Nau from Nairobi said seeing that Ms. Cho has been so thoroughly chastised, criticized, and contrite regarding her wild peanut aggravated fit, they should let her plead temporary insanity. After all, she's already lost her image, her jobs, her dignity, and maybe even her family heritage. Ben from Hawaii says, temporary insanity, I bet she's been getting away with other stuff we don't know about for years, like abusing her employees at home and work. That is our audience response segment on The Voice of America. Coming up on VOA Global, by the way, I'm Ira Melman. Jim Stevenson has this day off. You will hear Jim's interview that he did a couple of weeks ago. We're going to repeat it now, dealing with an author and talking about the future of China politically.
Will China dominate the 21st century? That's a question that has been asked and written about often, and a question answered in recent years as most likely yes. But not everyone is convinced because of several different factors. I'm Jim Stevenson with Authors on Asia, and we opened the book today with Jonathan Fembi, a former editor of the South China Morning Post in Hong Kong and author of Will China Dominate the 21st Century? He spoke with me about his view of modern China and the challenges he sees for its government.
I think we have here the last major state on earth run by a communist party. You may say that the system which runs China is quite largely influenced by capitalism and the market, but it is still a communist party, which is the sole political party running China. And I think that is leading it into increasing contradictions, as Mao Zedong would have put it, which actually inhibit its ability to develop and to reach a position of dominance if it wished to. I mean, I'm not convinced that China actually wants to dominate the world.
The government has shown some flexibility in its economic outlook and trying a few different things like the recent economic zone in Shanghai. But do you feel that these things have any chance of pushing China into a more dominant role? Or why will the government, even though it seems to be flexible, will hold it back?
China was coming from a long way back. It threw a lot of cheap labor, cheap capital, and strong export markets at this process of growth. And that produced this enormous upsurge in China from the 1980s through to the present day. I don't think China is going to collapse. I think it's still going to be there as one of the major influences globally. But the path ahead is looking a good deal more difficult.
There are some extraordinary pressures that China would be facing in the coming 50 to 100 years, especially with an aging population and some potentially serious health issues weighing on the state.
Absolutely, because growth has gone ahead without much effective concern for other issues. The environmental issue, there was a survey done last year by a number of international universities which reckoned that if you've been born this century in China, your life expectancy in northern cities, which is where the pollution is, the worst pollution is, will be cut by 5.5 years. On top of this is the question of what I call the trust deficit, that people don't believe in the cleanliness of the air, the cleanliness of water, in food safety, the lack of the rule by law. All these create difficult social issues and social tensions which the administration is going to have to deal with.
Would you say that the internal pressures on China are greater than the external ones in the argument that it will not be dominating in the 21st century?
Yes, I think the first concern of the Chinese leadership with the new Communist Party leader Xi Jinping is domestic. International affairs, foreign affairs don't matter that much for China so long as China doesn't feel threatened by external powers, so long as it doesn't feel that other powers are going to intervene in its internal affairs or that its access to iron ore, to oil and to other resources which it needs are going to be under threat. And my argument in my book is that those domestic problems are so challenging. I don't say necessarily they'll turn out badly, but they are so challenging for China that its prime focus is internal rather than external.
Jonathan Fenby is former editor of the South China Morning Post in Hong Kong and author of Will China Dominate the 21st Century? I'm Jim Stevenson. We'll pull another volume from our bookshelves next Thursday when you may hear more authors on Asia on VOA Global or anytime by visiting the voanews.com website.
I'm Sarah Williams with China Focus. In recent years, Tibetan communities worldwide have embraced a protest movement called Lhokhar that emphasizes Tibetan culture and identity, which exile leaders warn is under threat of being destroyed by Chinese policies. Anjana Pasricha visited a junior school in Dharamsala in India, where a third generation of Tibetans growing up in exile are working to stay rooted to the homeland they've never seen.
It's Wednesday, the day students at the Tibetan village children's school in Dharamsala pray and participate in an important ritual. Instead of their usual uniforms, girls come wearing an ethnic tunic and boys a traditional shirt. Wearing the chuba connects 10-year-old Sering Paldan to the homeland she only knows through tales.
I feel when I wear this dress, I feel I'm in Tibet.
This is the spirit of Lhokhar, a weekly ritual that emerged inside Tibet following the mass protests in 2008. Now many Tibetans worldwide have embraced the Wednesday practice of dressing, dining, or buying Tibetan in what is considered a silent defiance of Chinese rule. Lhokhar contains not only an educational component that reinforces Tibetans' ethnic identity, it also can be a potentially powerful political force, says Jyotsna Sara George of Students for a Free Tibet.
This was like a sort of decollectivization of protest, where it became about individual expression of your identity as a Tibetan, of your assertion as a Tibetan, that I am now taking charge of the way my culture is going to be viewed and the way my culture is going to be a means of resistance to assimilation to the Chinese culture.
Just as important, the practice helps connect younger people with their fellow Tibetans living inside China and those scattered across the world, says Lobsang Seten of the International Tibet Network.
Every freedom struggle to sustain, you need the younger generations. You need to keep their roots. And I think this is one example that we saw, how younger generations praying and then specifically celebrating Lhokhar.
Here in Dharamsala, the campaign appears to be working among students like Sering Paldan and Tenzin Rabge.
Yes, I want to visit Tibet.
Yes, I want to go.
Thousands of Tibetans fled to India after Chinese troops marched into Tibet in 1950 and announced what China called Tibet's peaceful liberation. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, New Delhi.
When it comes to hot beverages, China has long been a tea-drinking nation. But as VOA's Bill Ide reports, Chinese interest in a different brew is starting to percolate both in city cafes and southern farms that are switching to a more lucrative crop.
In big Chinese cities, one does not have to look far to find a coffee shop. By some estimates, coffee consumption here is rising 7 times faster than the global average.
I'll often grab a cup of coffee in the morning when I'm sleepy before I go to work or in the afternoon.
With more people gulping down Java, many see an opportunity for Chinese-grown beans.
For those of us who have been drinking coffee for a while, it is more than a question of convenience. It is not that easy to get domestically made coffee. I imagine most of the coffee we drink is from international distributors.
Most of China's coffee is grown in southern Yunnan province. A French missionary brought plants to the region over a century ago, but coffee growing did not pick up until more recently. Swiss food giant Nestle has been working with farmers in Yunnan for more than 2 decades to develop a sustainable green coffee industry and raise the productivity and quality of the Arabica crop that is grown there. In Pu'er, a city better known for its pungent black tea, Nestle has a buying station and coffee center, which is managed by Walter de Smet. He says the first challenge was educating farmers.
Coffee is new, okay? How to grow coffee, how to prepare the land, how to prepare the small plants.
De Smet and his team work with more than 2,600 coffee farms across Pu'er and nearby Shishuang Bana. Bill Ide, VOA News, Yunnan, China.
Follow us on Weibo. That's China Focus. I'm Sarah Williams.
This is VOA Global from the Voice of America. Jim Stevenson has the day off. I'm Ira Melman, and here is Asia Business News. The handful of Asian stock markets opened for trading on the last day of 2014 mostly rose modestly, led by China, which is nearing a 52% gain for the year. China's Shanghai Composite was up 0.7% at 31.87 Wednesday. Again, as we just said, a 52% for the year makes it Asia's best-performing market. The rally was driven by hopes Beijing will do more to reverse the slowdown in the world's second-largest economy. Hong Kong's Hang Seng added 0.4%, closed at 23.605. Taiwan and Singapore were little changed. India's Sensex rose 0.3% to 27.483. Australia's S&P ASX 200 dropped 0.1% to 54.11. Markets were closed in Japan, South Korea, and most of Southeast Asia. Almost all Asian stock markets are closed on New Year's Day. A survey of Chinese manufacturers found their activity contracted in December. In a new sign, the world's second-largest economy is slowing despite government efforts to shore up growth. HSBC Corporation said its monthly purchasing managers index fell to 49.6 on a 100-point scale, on which numbers below 50 show activity contracting. Markets were expecting that outcome since a preliminary version of the survey released earlier in the month also showed a contraction. Remember, you can hear Asian business news every day on VOA Global from the Voice of America. Stay with us.
This is Today in History. On January 1st, 45 BC, the Julian calendar, introduced by Roman Emperor Julius Caesar, was put into use. Over the centuries, however, it proved inaccurate in determining the solar year. The Gregorian calendar, devised in the 16th century, sought to correct the error and is widely followed today. In 1785, The Times was first published in London under a different name. The Times remains the city's oldest daily newspaper. In 1863, U.S. President Abraham Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation went into effect. The executive order in the midst of the American Civil War declared freedom for all slaves in areas of the rebel Confederacy not under U.S. government control. It transformed the nation's bloodiest conflict from a war over secession to a moral struggle against slavery. On this day in 1892, the first of millions of immigrants to the United States passed through the doors of the Ellis Island Immigrant Processing Center in New York Harbor. Thus began 62 years of operation in which the ancestors of millions of Americans began new lives in America. In 1895, John Edgar Hoover The first director of the U.S. Federal Bureau of Investigation was born. Under Hoover's 48-year tenure, the FBI would become one of the world's premier crime-fighting organizations. In 1912, the Republic of China was established on this date. In 1942, 26 governments signed a declaration vowing to use all their resources in the conflict against the Axis powers of Nazi Germany, Fascist Italy, and Japan. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
And now, VOA's International Edition. Coming up, recovery of passengers from that Air Asia plane and the case of Palestinian statehood. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Two coffins carrying the bodies of Air Asia crash victims arrived at a hospital in the Indonesian city of Surabaya on Wednesday for identification. Budiono, chief of the Surabaya Disaster Victim Identification, told reporters police in Surabaya collecting DNA samples and photographs from relatives to help speed up the identification process. He also said they hope to have the results of the ID process soon. He said when they finish, they will be giving it to the Air Asia people, who will then pass it on to the families. The first debris and bodies from the plane, which crashed into the Java Sea about 40 minutes into a flight from Indonesia to Singapore on Sunday, were found on Tuesday. Officials say a total of 7 bodies have been recovered off the coast of Borneo so far. There were 162 people aboard the plane. Air Asia CEO Tony Fernandez, who visited the center of the recovery operation, said the bad weather is making things difficult.
The weather, unfortunately, is not looking good for the next 2 or 3 days, and that is slowing us down. But they did inform me that the ships are looking to operate 24 hours, which is very encouraging, and they're moving all the assets to the two spots which they think where the aircraft could be.
About 30 ships and 21 aircraft from Indonesia, Australia, Malaysia, Singapore, South Korea, and the United States have been involved in the search. So far, the aircraft's data recorders, also known as black boxes, have not been found. Also in the news, Palestinian officials are seeking to join the International Criminal Court now that a draft resolution setting a deadline for Israel to withdraw from occupied land failed in the UN Security Council. The United States vetoed that draft resolution on Tuesday. Palestinians have been trying to build international pressure against Israel since the breakdown of bilateral talks in April. Henry Ridgewell reports.
The draft resolution called for Israel to withdraw from the occupied territories by the end of 2017. Explaining the United States veto, U.S. Ambassador to the UN Samantha Power said peace can only come from what she called hard choices and compromises.
We know that those hardships will not cease and those threats will not subside until the parties reach a comprehensive settlement achieved through negotiations.
The U.S. objections were understandable, says Professor Rosemary Hollis of City University London, speaking via Skype.
In terms of what it would take to implement a resolution that is not agreed to by the parties to the conflict, if Israel is not agreed to withdrawing from the territories the Israelis occupied in 1967, including East Jerusalem, which clearly they're not at the moment, then who exactly would oblige them to make that withdrawal?
Israel called the Security Council decision a victory for common sense. Emmanuel Nakshon is spokesman for the Israeli Foreign Ministry.
We hope that the Palestinians understand that the only way to move forward with the peace process is by negotiating with Israel and not by continuing this unilateral strategy.
Palestinian officials say they may now seek to join the International Criminal Court in The Hague. Ahmed Asaf is spokesman for President Mahmoud Abbas's Fatah Party. He said the Security Council failed in protecting the goals on which it was founded and the principles which it usually defends. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Suicide bomber blew himself up in the middle of a gathering of Shiite Houthis in Yemen on Wednesday, killing more than two dozen people and wounding dozens more. Blast occurred as the Shiites were celebrating the birth of Prophet Muhammad at a cultural center that happened in the central city of Ibb. Many of the victims were women and children. There were no immediate claims of responsibility, but similar bombings have been carried out by al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, which operates in Yemen and regards Shiites as heretics. Officials in southern Italy scrambled Wednesday to provide shelter for hundreds of migrants found aboard a freighter left adrift at sea. More than 900 migrants were said to be aboard, including Syrian refugees. Video of the disembarkation in Italy showed children on the deck being wrapped in blankets. The Italian military took control of the ship after discovering the crew of the freighter had abandoned the vessel and rigged the engine to crash it into the coast. World Health Organization says the number of new confirmed cases of Ebola in Liberia is declining. Liberians were once at the epicenter of this regional epidemic, but several parts of the country now have gone weeks without reporting any new cases. VOA's Ann Look has the story with reporting in Monrovia by Prince Collins.
The Dolo Town Health Center, just outside the Liberian capital, is open. Mothers bring their children for vaccinations against polio and measles. People come in for tuberculosis treatment and HIV counseling. A midwife here says she delivered 10 babies since they reopened a month ago. The sheer normalcy of it all has the feel of the remarkable. Liberia's health system collapsed in August as Ebola bore down on Monrovia. Dolo Town was one of two suburbs put under an abrupt quarantine. The quarantine was lifted 2 weeks later, but the community continued to battle Ebola. Locals say more than four dozen people are believed to have died here of the virus. Even now at year's end, a local task force watches for sporadic cases. This newly opened clinic is not taking any chances. They built a special waiting area in front. Midwife Kebe Carmo keeps a close watch.
In setting on here, please. You know, we shouldn't set jam up, you know, beside one another. Because you don't know who is who. Ebola patient might be among us. We are protecting you and protecting ourselves.
Staff wear gloves. They screen for Ebola symptoms like fever and send those patients to a larger care center nearby. The clinic has a stock of PPEs just in case. That's the full body protective gear staff should wear if they see a suspected Ebola case.
That is VOA's Ann Look reporting. World Health Organization says the death toll from the Ebola outbreak in West Africa now reaches 7,905 out of a total of 20,206 cases of confirmed, probable, and suspected cases of Ebola. Well, that's some of the stories we're looking at here on The Voice of America. There's always more at voanews.com. And if you're following the conversation about the news on Twitter, you can find me at VOA Norman. Have a great Thursday and a happy new year.
This is Business News from the Voice of America in Washington. I'm Ira Melman. U.S. stocks wrapped up a solid year on a down note, erasing early gains to end with sizable losses Wednesday. The S&P 500 fell 21.45 points, about 1%, to finish 2014 at 5,058.90. The benchmark gained 11.4% for the year. The Dow Jones Industrial Average slid 160 points, 0.9%, ended at 17,823, below the 18,000 mark, and briefly gained again on Wednesday. Left the blue chip gauge with a 7.5% rise for the year. Some market watchers said there was no single factor behind the stock market's choppy action Wednesday, and investors shouldn't read that much into its moves on light pre-holiday volume. Benchmark U.S. crude was down 53 cents at $53.59 a barrel in electronic trading on the New York Mercantile Exchange, and is down about 46% for the year as demand weakened while supply stayed high. The contract rose 51% Tuesday. There's no NYMEX trading on New Year's Day. Brent crude, a benchmark for international oils, was down 72 cents at $57.18 a barrel on the ICE exchange in London. The Apple company is expected to suffer its first decline in iPad shipments since the tablet's launch in 2010. It's further evidence that the device is being squeezed by larger screen phones. A California-based iPad maker needs to ship almost as many tablets in the final 3 months of 2014 as it did in all of the first 9 months, just to hold even with 2013, according to the market intelligence company ABI Research. That's a look at business news from VOA. Well, just a few hours at least here in Washington, D.C., before the new year kicks in. We all wish you and wish you all a happy, happy new year, if it is not already that new year where you are. And it will be better late, but it won't be never. And it's free. We're talking about the new VOA calendar. Write us for one. Give us your address, your name, at VOA Asia on Facebook. I'm Ira Melman in the American Cafe. As winter sets in across much of the Northern Hemisphere, there are indications that this year could be even colder than last, when polar temperatures kept us in a deep freeze. Cold blasts from the Arctic set record lows for this century. But as VOA's Roseanne Scurble reports, a new study finds that all of that cold air may actually be good for your health.
It seems that no matter how many layers of clothes they put on, everyone is shivering. That involuntary reflex is the focus of a new study in the journal Cell Metabolism. It finds that shivering triggers the body to release a natural hormone called irisin, which activates brown fat, the good fat in your body that burns calories and promotes weight loss. Lead author Francesco Celli at Virginia Commonwealth University says irisin plays another important role.
Indeed, the purpose of brown fat is maintaining the core temperature, so the temperature of the body whereby all the vital functions can be active and normal.
Celli worked with a team at the U.S. National Institutes of Health. They knew the body produces irisin when we exercise. They hypothesized that shivering, which, like exercising, also makes muscles contract, evolved as a survival mechanism in response to cold.
This is the last ditch before going in hypothermia and having severe metabolic and life-threatening consequences. Now, one hypothesis is an hypothesis until you prove it.
Volunteers were recruited to test hormonal changes and energy expenditure with exercise and while lying under cooling blankets, where temperatures were gradually reduced to 12 degrees Celsius.
Most of our volunteers shivered at that time, and the shivering was anywhere between 5 and 10 minutes, no more. And again, we drew blood before and after the study.
The volunteers' bodies produced irisin, but with some surprises.
The amount of increase in irisin was almost identical to what we observed after 1 hour of exercise. This first set of experiments validated our initial hypothesis, whereby the maximum stimulation of irisin is probably shivering.
Celli says understanding how irisin activates brown fat and consequently the burning of calories could lead to new drugs to fight diabetes or obesity. Roseanne Scurble, VOA News, Washington.
Trash in waterways around the world is a major environmental issue. The U.S. city of Baltimore, Maryland is tackling its problem with a one-of-a-kind contraption with a water wheel that pulls in garbage. VOA's Deborah Block is here in the cafe with more.
This odd-looking contraption sits on the Jones Falls River that flows into Baltimore's harbor. Every year, storm runoff from city streets carries huge amounts of garbage and debris into the river, polluting the harbor. Adam Lindquist is with the Waterfront Partnership of Baltimore, the group that sponsored the water wheel.
After a rainstorm, we would get a lot of trash in Baltimore Harbor. Sometimes the trash was so bad it looked like you could walk across the harbor on nothing but trash.
Containment booms funnel trash and debris toward the gadget, where a leaf rake pulls it in and onto a moving conveyor that drops the garbage into a dumpster. The dumpster is on a floating dock that can be pulled to shore by boat, where the waste is burned to create electrical energy. The water wheel is more efficient than the way the garbage was being picked up, using small boats with nets. Daniel Chase, co-designer of the device, says it can remove 45,000 metric tons of garbage each day.
Instead of chasing one or two pieces of trash around at a time, we just stand at the source of it and catch it all at once.
Deborah Block, VOA News, Baltimore.
I'm Ira Melman in the American Cafe. Join us daily on VOA Global or as a podcast from voanews.com and many podcast platforms.
Hi, everyone. I'm David Byrd, and here's what's happening now. It's the holiday season, and many of us will be attending parties to celebrate. Some of that celebration might include alcohol, whether you have a little Christmas cheer, a hot toddy for the body, or maybe you'll ring in the new year with some bubbly. But what do you do if you have too much and the next day you feel awful?
Hangover, 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 hangover. Party's over, it ain't over. Try to make a bag of memory over and over. Hangover, hangover.
For some folks in New York City, a trip to a special clinic might be just what the doctor ordered. This clinic has intravenous fluids to help you get over your hangover. The IVs contain saline, vitamins, and some anti-nausea medication. Dehydration and electrolyte imbalance contribute to a hangover, so these fluids help get your system back to normal. Dr. Jake Deutsch is one of the doctors that gives these IVs. He told the Associated Press that the treatments aren't cheap, but when compared to the expense of missing a day's work, some of his patients think it's worth it.
You're going to be running around $200. So in terms of loss of productivity, in terms of the cost of not being able to make a meeting or not being able to do your normal day, people would look at that as insignificant. But yes, of course, there's a business aspect to it, but all medicine is business.
Computer science student Jacob Silverman and neuroscience student Anka Marinesco were patients at the clinic. The night before, they had split three quarters of a bottle of scotch, but they're not feeling it.
Honestly, I can't even, remember feeling bad. Pretty much within, 5 minutes of them putting it in, I felt great. I feel like I didn't drink at all last night.
Well, as a student, it's kind of unavoidable, I think. People are going to drink. I'm going to continue to drink, and, I'm sure I'm going to get some more hangovers, so.
These kinds of anti-hangover clinics have opened in New York, Chicago, Atlanta, and Miami. But Dr. Lorenzo Leggio of the National Institutes of Health told the AP he doesn't think that they're a good idea.
In my opinion, it should not be allowed for the simple reason that there is not scientific evidence that suggests that such a treatment is effective.
Dr. Leggio says that treating a hangover isn't helping the real problem, overuse and abuse of alcohol.
The concern with this approach is that doctors are treating a consequence of excessive alcohol use, but they are not addressing the underlying medical problem, which is the excessive alcohol use.
Wake up in the morning, do the same shoe.
Speaking of drinking, a Canadian runner won the inaugural Flow Track Beer Mile Championships this month in Austin, Texas. What's a beer mile? Well, the event requires competitors to drink four beers over a one-mile run on a standard athletics track. The beer has to be a standard 0.36-liter one, and it has to be at least 5% alcohol. Runners have to drink the beer within a 10-meter transition zone at the finish line. If you get sick, you have to run another lap. Canadian Corey Gallagher of Winnipeg won the men's event with a personal best of 5 minutes, 23 one-hundredths of a second.
Super excited. This was amazing to run down. When you hit those straights, see the people cheering and the runners around you and everything, it was probably the greatest atmosphere and running event I've probably ever been at. Like, this was, without a doubt, the best thing I've been a part of.
The women's title in the elite race went to 29-year-old Elizabeth Herndon of Kent, Ohio. She finished in 6 minutes, 17.76 seconds. So what do you think? Let us know your opinion by logging on to our Facebook page, VOA Asia. And you can always email your questions or comments to voaasia@voanews.com. And that's what's happening now. Until next time, I'm David Byrd.
This is VOA Global from the Voice of America. Jim Stevenson is off. I'm Ira Melman. Another weather anomaly. A lot of that's happening of late. As 2014 wraps up, the city of Las Vegas in the desert in the U.S. may be in the midst of switching places with Anchorage, Alaska. Weather-wise, right now it's 41 degrees in Anchorage, 34 degrees in Las Vegas. Things have switched around weather-wise around here. From the Voice of America in Washington, I'm Ira Melman, looking at sports. Los Angeles Lakers future NBA Hall of Famer Kobe Bryant is leaning toward retirement after next season. So reports the Orange County Register newspaper, which is quoting Bryant and saying, if he asked me if I was going to play beyond that, right now the answer is no. Bryant hasn't slowed down much on the court. He's averaging 24.1 points a game, though if he finished the season with his current shooting percentage of 37.5%, it would easily be a career low. Next season would be his 20th with the Lakers. Oklahoma City Thunder superstar Kevin Durant is likely to make his return from a six-game absence Wednesday night against visiting Phoenix, so says ESPN. The forward has been sidelined with an ankle problem. Injuries have limited him to just 9 games this season, but he practiced both Monday and Tuesday. Baseball news, the Associated Press annually names a male and female athlete of the year. This year's male winner is San Francisco Giants postseason workhorse Madison Bumgarner. Bumgarner did much more than just shine in the postseason. Of course, he made his second straight All-Star game and finished the season with an 18-10 record with a 2.98 earned run average and 209 strikeouts and 217 and a third regular season innings. The female winner was Little League star Monet Davis. Unbeaten champion Takashi Uchiyama of Japan fended off a challenge from Israel Perez of Argentina Wednesday in Tokyo to defend his World Boxing Association super featherweight title for the ninth time. The veteran Japanese, who's 35 years old, remained in control throughout the bout, sending a barrage of body punches toward his challenger, who's also 35 years old, who kept his guards high. The headline bout was a part of the WBA triple header that also saw Ryoichi Taguchi of Japan rise to become the new light flyweight champion with a unanimous decision dethroning Alberto Rossell of Peru. Tune in every day for the latest in sports from the Voice of America in Washington. I'm Ira Melman.
Hi, I'm Ray McDonald on the Voice of America, and this is the Top 5 Countdown. We're welcoming the 5 most popular songs in the Billboard Hot 100 Pop Singles Chart for the week ending January 3rd, 2015. It's a new year, and what do you know? I have a new song for you. That's yet to come. First, let's visit Meghan Trainor in 5th place. Meghan just celebrated a landmark birthday with another chart star. I'll have details after. Lips are moving. I know you're lying. Trainor steps back a slot to 5th place with Lips Are Movin'. Last week, Meghan turned 21 years old and her pal Nick Jonas helped her celebrate. Nick and Megan performed together at the Z100 Jingle Ball concert, and Nick brought out a cake for her during the show. The crowd sang happy birthday, and the New York Daily News reports Megan got a little teary-eyed. Ed Sheeran knows his way around a tearjerker. Witness his hit The A-Team. Well, this week he climbs two slots to fourth place with another winner, Thinking Out Loud. Ed had a massive year. Hold on for more.
So honey, now take me into your loving arms. Kiss me under the light of a thousand stars. Place your head on my beating heart. I'm thinking now.
Ed Sheeran hits a Hot 100 high as Thinking Out Loud jumps two slots to fourth place. Streaming service Spotify says Ed was the world's most streamed artist of 2014, with his Multiply set taking top album honors. Holding in third place are Mark Ronson and Bruno Mars with Uptown Funk. Bruno just made himself at home in Southern California. Details are on the way.
Girl said you hallelujah. Girl said you hallelujah. I'll set you hallelujah. Ooh. Cause Uptown Funk don't give it to you. Ooh.
Cause Uptown Funk.
Mark Ronson and Bruno Mars hold in third place on the Hot 100 with Uptown Funk. Meanwhile, it just retook the number one spot in the United Kingdom. Bruno recently paid $6.5 million for a large estate in Studio City, California. Variety reports it features 7 bedrooms, 8 bathrooms, and a 6-car garage. Bruno also owns a second California residence, along with one in his home state of Hawaii. And then there's Hozier, who says he recorded the vocal track for Take Me to Church at 2 o'clock in the morning in his attic. He never expected it to be a hit. I'll have more after the song.
Take me to church, I worship like a dog at the shrine of your light. I'll tell you my sins and you can sharpen your knife. Offer me that deathless death, the good God, let me give you my life. Take me to church.
Spends another week in second place with Take Me to Church. He tells Contact Music that he never even expected it to be played on the radio, much less earn a Song of the Year Grammy nomination. Our number one artist is in the running for 3 Grammys. I'll take a closer look after Blank Space.
And I'll write your name.
Taylor Swift hangs on for a 6th big week at number one with Blank Space. Taylor has won 7 Grammy Awards and may collect 3 more. She's up for Record of the Year, Song of the Year, and Best Pop Solo Performance, all for Shake It Off. Trophies get handed out on February 8th. Well, now that we're in the new year, it's full speed ahead. Join me next week for a fresh hit list. I'm Ray McDonald, and this has been the Top 5 Countdown on The Voice of America.
Here on VOA Global, a New Year's story for you. The Prime Minister of Belgium has laughed off an incident in which he was pelted with chips and squirted with mayonnaise. Nice way to welcome in the new year. Charles Michel was speaking at a business event in the southern city of Namur in Belgium when 4 female activists began shouting, "Michel, get out, austerity, get out." They then rushed forward. One of them threw chips at the 39-year-old prime minister. The others squirted him with mayonnaise. The women who were wearing masks eventually walked out after a bemused looking Mr. Michel was led away to a side room. He restarted his speech, apologizing to the audience, saying that "I smell of mayonnaise." Chips are a Belgian specialty and are often served with a heavy dollop of mayonnaise. Mr. Michel's spokesman said he would not press charges over the incident. And a dog has been credited with saving the life of its owner after nudging him and alerting him to a fire inside his California home. The man told Sacramento firefighters that he was sleeping when Buddy, his chocolate Labrador, woke him up last Thursday night. Man saw a fire burning in a bedroom in the rear of the house but was able to escape alive. This is our time to wish you a very happy new year. If you are not in it already, have fun celebrating the new year coming in the next few hours. My name is Ira Melman. Tracy Carter is our director, our technical director, Zeinab Abdelrahman, and Diane Gao is our executive director. Have yourself a wonderful new year from everybody here at the Voice of America.